Today we have Albert Stebbins from Fermi Lab, who's going to give us a very interesting sounding talk on fast radio bursts and crab nanoshots. As usual, we're going to go to lunch with the speaker immediately afterwards, so feel free to join in the bistro. And there's also going to be speaker dinner tonight at 6:30, hosted by Liquid. Thanks.
Okay, thank you for inviting me to this wonderful institute. It's really cool. I like it. I like it. Yeah. So anyway, so I'm going to talk about something which I knew nothing about a year ago. Well, that's not quite true. A year and a half ago. So maybe I don't know too much more. So a lot of these words you may not have heard of. Cosmology you probably heard of. And a lot of this work was done with a student at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, Ho-Jin Yo, who's now at LBL. All right, so in the Department of Energy, who I work for, more or less, we're not supposed to say these words very much anymore. We used to talk about frontiers, the energy frontier, the cosmic frontier, the intensity frontier, and we've been sort of transitioning from energy to intensity. But there's another frontier in astronomy, which I think is sort of interesting. I don't know if it's as deep, and that's brightness. So I'll define brightness in a few seconds. But the thing is that in radio astronomy, there's these phenomena, which you may not have heard of, which are extremely bright. And it's sort of enigmatic what these things might be. So the reason I got into this was because of something called fast radio bursts. But anyways, there's this plot in a paper by Keen et al., which plots basically nu times w. Nu's the frequency they're observing at. W's the width of the burst. This is a plot of radio transients. So that's what the x-axis is.
So width is how long it lasts, or what is the width? Yeah.
How long it lasts. It's sort of how long it lasts. And the y-axis is the total energy released by the source.
It's the energy or luminosity?
It's the total energy. The peak luminosity. By the source. And on this plot, there are all sorts of things you probably know about: solar bursts or solar radio emission associated with sunspots and things like that. There's pulsar pulses, individual pulses of pulsars. There's rotating transients. You may not have heard of those. But there was this new phenomenon called fast radio bursts. The first one was discovered in the mid-2000s. It's called the Lorimer burst, and since then several have been discovered, and I'll talk more about those later. So the thing that got me going on this was there's this thing you could define in for electromagnetic radiation, which is the brightness temperature. At that frequency, something that's emitting that intensity, what would the temperature have to be if it was a thermal emission to emit it? And so that's how I'm sort of quantifying brightness. Mm-hmm. So that's these diagonal lines. So brightness increases that way. And these fast radio bursts are very bright. But there's this other thing which I never heard of. Is this a question or?
Temperature scale seems to be divergent.
Right. So there's this thing called crab NS. I had no idea what that was. So I had to do some research to figure out what this point meant. And NS stands for nano shot, which I'll describe later. Now, if you want to impress people, you could draw a line on here. It's when is the brightness temperature equal to the Planck mass times c squared? That's this line here. So some of these things have a brightness temperature bigger than the Planck mass. Now, presumably there's no trans-Planckian physics involved. I don't guarantee it, but I don't think so. But these brightness temperatures are extremely large, and from a sort of very naive point of view, it seems ridiculously large, impossible, whatever. But that's not really true if you think a bit more deeply. So basically, there's this blue and the white. They divide things into coherent and incoherent radiation. The brighter things are coherent radiation. What is that? Well, anyway, suppose we represent the charges by a flock of birds, in this case seagulls, and all these seagulls seem to be more or less moving randomly. So if you figure out if these are charged birds, they'll emit electromagnetic radiation as they move around. And if they're moving randomly, they're not uncorrelated with each other, then the power you get would be the sum of the power from each of the individual birds. So that's incoherent radiation. And most of the radiation you see in astrophysics is of that type, or the thermal radiation you get from the sun or bouncing off the wall. That's what you have. But something else can happen, sort of represented by this flock of starlings. Now you see these starlings, they're all sort of moving together. And if you look at, if these were charged starlings and they were emitting radiation, if you looked on wavelengths bigger than the inter-starling distance, the brightness you get is not just the sum of the brightness of individual starlings, but rather it would go as the number of starlings squared, which could be quite large. And so that is believed to be what is the cause of this very, very bright emission. And there's a type of phenomena called electromagnetic pulse. You may have heard of it in the context of nuclear weapons destroying all our valuable electronics. But basically, it's caused when you get charge separation. Basically, lots of charge, positive charge separated from negative charges. They'll come together because they attract, or if they're in a large electric field, they might move apart, and you'll get this very large emission. So that is coherent radiation. All right? And so basically, you can think about things. I talked about temperature and thermodynamics. So basically, what this is telling you is that in the electromagnetic field, or in the world, there's these large coherent modes. And so there's a large amount of energy crammed into a small amount of phase space. That's what a large temperature means. And super Planckian temperature is common for all sorts of macroscopic phenomena. Probably the kinetic energy, if I twirl this hockey stick, is probably bigger than the Planck mass. That's one mode. So you might say the brightness temperature of this hockey stick is bigger than the Planck mass, and that's not odd. So it's basically a manifestation of macroscopic electromagnetic phenomena. And we find that in all sorts of places. Electric fish do that, I guess, to defend themselves. They also, I guess, use it to communicate. We build capacitors that contain large amounts of electromagnetic energy. Power lines have very, very high brightness temperature, as you could witness if you actually seen one of these things short out. At Fermilab, we have large magnets that have very, very large amounts of energies in single modes. And so macroscopic electromagnetic radiation is common, and that's sort of the idea behind these coherent emissions from these radio things. But what specifically is it? Well, a particular type of electromagnetic radiation that coherent electromagnetic radiation comes from something called magnetic field recombination. And we see that all the time in, reconnection, excuse me. We see that all the time in, let me go back and do this again. So here's a case of you can get, if you have sunspots, you can get the fields to reconnect. That will induce a large amount of charge, which will move off. You also get a large amount of radiation emitted. And this sunspot, the charge that gets emitted might hit the Earth's magnetosphere, as represented in this plot, cause the magnetic field behind the Earth to reconnect. So it's one reconnection causing another reconnection. That's sort of indicated here as the wave goes around the Earth's magnetosphere. When these fields reconnect, you accelerate particles at very high energy. And that's the reason you get aurora. So this sort of magnetic field reconnection you see all the time in all sorts of astrophysical phenomena. And so they produce, and it's basically the conversion of energy from large coherent magnetic fields going into other sorts of energy, producing these somewhat higher frequency. So it's basically taking those low frequency modes and converting them into higher frequency modes, and also accelerating particles, which are converting them to even higher frequency modes, as indicated by the light, the charged particles causing the aurora in the Earth. So it's natural to think that these sort of things you see in the radio are something like this. And here's actually pictures of that phenomena, magnetic reconnection in the star. You get very bright emission. Here's a sunspot, one of the brightest sunspots in the past 22 years. Here's sparks. You see these sparks. So basically, this is sort of magnetic field reconnection accelerating particles which produce light. And so.
What's the
time scale? This is days. Yeah. And probably the brightest thing you've ever seen is a lightning bolt. So this is a high-speed photography of a lightning bolt. If you looked at some of the frames, this entire frame is saturated. You know, the reason that, you know, it's much brighter than the sun, but it only lasts a short period of time, so it does less damage to your eyes than the sun would if you look at it. Here's a pretty amazing picture that was taken last year. It's 10,000 frames a second picture of sprite lightning. So this is tens of miles up in the atmosphere, basically. And basically, all this is converting this large electromagnetic energy from a large electric field in the atmosphere into higher frequency modes, including accelerating lots of particles. And so there's lots of charged particles here, and they're all moving in the same direction. So they produce coherent radiation. So now that I've convinced you that this sort of phenomena is very common, even though it probably doesn't occur in many of the astrophysical things you're used to, let's go to the really interesting stuff, like the crab radio pulse structure. So here's a plot from McGallagher et al. At 1.2 gigahertz of the average radio emission from the crab pulsar. So here's the period. It goes from the left of the plot to the right of the plot. There's two pulses. The pulses are very, very narrow. And so the length of this, this pulse is 30 milliseconds. Okay. Now, in the beginning when people, you know, the crab pulsar was seen as a pulsar. That's what they saw at lower frequencies where the pulses are wider. But as they built better radio telescopes, bigger radio telescopes that observed it at a higher frequency, they could see the structure of these pulses in more detail. Now, this is an average pulse. And I guess you can't see the scale here. So here's a blow up of one of those average pulses. And so this is 1 to 10 microseconds. And you can see that, at least for this particular pulse, it's not at all like this. And it's not at all like random noise, you know, sort of uniform random noise. You get these things, which they call giant pulses, which can be thousands of times brighter than the average pulse. So the pulse of a crab pulsar varies quite a bit. And this can happen on the microsecond time scale. And I'm sorry, the contrast isn't very good. So if you blow this up even further, maybe you can just sort of, I'll have a blow up of this later, you get these smaller structures that happen on the microsecond time scale called microbursts that are part of these giant radio pulses. The giant radio pulses were another set of points on that brightness plot I showed in the beginning. And so you see that if you blow that up, there's structure on very, very small scales, tens or several nanoseconds, actually. So this is by Jessner et al. This is a group, Hankins et al., which actually first discovered this phenomena. And this is the brightest thing that's ever been seen, I think, in the universe. It's a nanoshot, because nanosecond time scale. This was from the crab pulsar, which is 2 kiloparsecs away. And its brightness was 2 megajanskis. So brighter, about the brightness of the sun, even though it's much, 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 much further away. So it only lasted a nanosecond.
What frequency are they looking at there?
Well, here they're looking at 10, like 8 to 10 gigahertz. Well, I shouldn't say that. The way you do these observations is sort of complicated. Basically, you have a radio receiver. You multiply at times a carrier wave, which might be, in this case, 8 or 10 gigahertz. And then you sample it at maybe 10, tens of gigasamples per second. No, a few gigasamples per second. It's hard to sample things much faster than that. So basically, they're sort of looking at the 10 gigahertz band, not the 1 gigahertz band in these last three plots. But they don't actually get the full bandwidth. They don't go from 0 to 10 gigahertz. They go from 10 gigahertz plus or minus 1 gigahertz. That's sort of their actual bandwidth.
So these pulses, in other words, are just lasting order one.
Okay, so hopefully you can maybe see this better. So and you must say that in all of these cases, the width of the pulse is not clearly resolved by the instrument. They could be shorter. They're close to the instrumental resolution of the detector, the way they detect things. Mm-hmm. So if you could see this better, there's a plot that shows intensity, which is in red. And they try to divide up into polarization. So there's linear polarization and circular polarization. And some of these nanoshot things are pretty close to 100% linearly polarized. Some of them are pretty close to 100% circularly polarized. And to get these things, you have to de-disperse things, basically, because when the radio waves travel to us through the atmosphere, or the plasma, interstellar medium, and the plasma around the Crab pulsar, it messes up these things. It causes the lower frequency waves to arrive later. So this is after a sort of optimal de-dispersing. Of course, they don't know actually how much de-dispersing they need to do. So this is just sort of to make it as pointy as possible, which maybe is a reasonable thing to do. Well, the usual theory of sort of scintillation of these things would actually smear them out, not make them sharper.
Yeah, but you can from cast it, right? I mean, like you do like, at the bottom of the pool, you just have a fraction through something like medium, some places you disperse, some places you disperse.
Well, something is moving, so nanosecond, as I'll get to, corresponds to a very small length scale. I think you need something. Well, you need something to be moving on a very small length scale.
Sort of time scale observed for scintillation changes is about 1 second to see. I mean, you're trying to say, optically somehow it's wiped over over the Earth or something. But yeah, empirically, again, there's not a theory of what causes these pockets, even the propagation one is fully understood. But empirically, you get maybe 1 second on a good day.
But I think that's just a choice of definition. It seems that you call the thing you see on a second.
No, it's due to the,
I guess my question is that, are there things that look much smoother than this, or anything that you zoom in craft pulses that look like this, basically?
Well, I don't know that. I mean, the observations I've seen only look at the Crab pulsar are very bright things. So ideally, you'd do an A-B comparison of, some other thing that was just as bright. Of course, if it wasn't so bright, you wouldn't be able to, the signal to noise would be much smaller. You wouldn't be able to see this. But since there's nothing else to compare it to, which, isn't a pulsar, I think. So it's difficult to do an A-B comparison. But it's a good point, I think. I think propagation effects are liable to be important, as I'll talk about. So anyways, if we take these things to be coming from a source that's not relativistically beamed towards us, so the Crab pulsar doesn't rotate close to relativistically, but not strongly relativistic. then the size of the region in which this emission comes from should be about 30 centimeters or less. So it's pretty small. The energy is about 10 to the 28 ergs, sort of given by this formula. This is a these nano shots vary quite a bit. So this is some number at I put a less than sign. So things can be an order of magnitude lower than this. For other ones, or depending on your definition, it could be two orders of magnitude lower than this. But still, this nanosecond size scale seems to be somewhat robust. The peak luminosity is about 1,000 solar luminosities from this basketball-sized region for a nanosecond. The electric field, so you can just take the electric field and cram it down into the basketball-sized region, like 1 over R, like radiation goes like. You find that the electric field is about 2 times 10 to the 12 Gauss. And you could figure out, well, suppose you're producing it by coherent radiation, like those starlings moving around coherently, how many starlings do you need, or how many electrons would you need? You'd need about 5 moles of electrons moving around across this basketball in a nanosecond. And with this electric field, these charged particles would be accelerated to about 10 PeV as they cross the basketball. So it's a pretty good particle accelerator, it seems like. So we can compare this with other things we think we know about the Crab pulsar. We don't think that this pulse comes from the interior of a neutron star. It must come from the surface or outside the surface. So a neutron star is believed to have a radius of about 10 kilometers. We can measure how much energy is being radiated from it, or at least the lower limit on the amount of energy being radiated from it, because we can see it spinning down. We have a good idea what the moment of inertia of a neutron star is. So from the spin down rate, you could say that the energy that's being lost by whatever mechanism is 10 to the 5 solar luminosities. So these nanoshot things, when they happen, is a small part of the energy budget of the pulsar. So that's not worrying. The 10 kilometers is sort of worrying. But the magnetic field, well, we don't really know the magnetic field of the Crab pulsar. You need to match models with observations, and models could vary. And maybe my thinking is that some of the models people have might be somewhat off. But typical numbers you can look up in books is 10 to the 13 Gauss. Do you have 10 to the 13 Gauss?
Is that the spin down magnetic field?
Well, that's if you assume that the spin down is due to magnetic dipole radiation, solely due to magnetic dipole radiation. That's the number you get. So the general idea that people have is that you have roughly a dipole magnetic field, nothing on the scale of a basketball, and it's rotating, and it emits radio waves at the poles, and we happen to be properly situated so the poles point to us during a small fraction of the time, and that's the source of, let's say, if we're up here, this would be the main pulse, and this would be the smaller interpulse. That's sort of the sort of general cartoon people generally use. What?
The size of the emitting region.
Of the what?
Emitting region.
Well, it's a few, I don't know, 100 meters, something like that.
The size of the emitting region.
Well, the emitting region is very big. It's sort of where are the source of the radio waves that actually get out is the question. So getting out is a big part of it. The emitting region is not exactly clear. Some people have it be in here. Some people have it be in there. Some people have it near the light cylinder. So it's hard to understand why it'd be such a narrow pulse. I mean, it's a very, very small fraction of the rotation period that the pulse is on if it's way out here, like near the light cylinder. So the emission mechanism for the pulsar is actually not really understood, but people have different models. So I'm going to give you a different model. The particle density, so we were talking about, several moles in a cubic, in a basketball. The particle density you can estimate from sort of the Goldreich-Julian model of a magnetosphere of a rotating magnetized thing. And you get numbers like 10 to the minus 3 moles per cubic meter, much, much smaller than the particle density you need to explain the nanoshot. So that's a red flag. That doesn't seem to fit very well. It seems like maybe the particles wouldn't normally be there. Maybe you're producing them in situ. Another thing is if you go to the near the pulsar, you can show that the pulsar will produce its own atmosphere. If it didn't have one to begin with, it would pair-produce and produce its own pair-plasma atmosphere. And you can calculate the density of that from the Goldreich-Julian model. You can calculate what the plasma frequency is. And that plasma frequency is about 250 gigahertz. So it's much, much higher than this 1 to 10 gigahertz thing I'm talking about. So that would, you know, so normally you'd say, well, it couldn't happen anywhere near the neutron star because the radio waves would never get out. But I'm going to argue that's not true later on. So the questions you would ask is, why are the nanoshots so small? How come they have so much charge involved in their emission mechanism? And how come they have such a low frequency? Of course, if you didn't resolve these nanoshots, you wouldn't be asking these questions. If you just saw the big pulse like we knew, you know, 30 years ago, you wouldn't be asking these questions. So radio transients and quantum electrodynamics, so I think they might be connected. So we certainly know that for neutron stars, quantum electrodynamic effects are important. So basically, you can define, I'm sorry, the exponent seemed to got cut off. X squared cubed. anyways, there's an electric field, I call it the Schwinger electric field. Some people call it the limiting electric field. I wouldn't call it that. Given by this, it's basically 4 times 10 to the 14 Gauss. And the magnetic field in pulsars, if a pulsar has a magnetic field bigger than that, then that's some people's definition of what they call a magnetar. But anyways, the Crab pulsar is close to that with an order of magnitude or about an order of magnitude of that. So these QED effects can be important. And people near here, like Chris Thompson, have written lots of papers on things like that. So they should exhibit all sorts of interesting QED phenomena. It'd be really cool if we were up close to one of these stars, we could do more detailed measurements. But a lot of these things can only be inferred by what little we can observe.
What's photons?
What
is photons?
So basically, if a large magnetic field, photons, like gamma ray photons, will travel at different frequencies, at different speeds. It's like a vacuum dispersion effect. Okay. The thing is, if we know the distance to the source and we know the distance to the Crab pulse, we can figure out what the electric field is. And that's what I did in the previous slides. I got 2 times 10 to the 12 Gauss for that. So naively, if you just took the Schwinger critical field, and you drew it on this plot, it would be up here. And you'd say, well, all of these things are quite a few, or at least 2 orders of magnitude away from, or several orders of magnitude away from this. But that's sort of misleading, actually.
Sorry, how did you put that up there?
Well, I just used the same formula. I took the electric field, and I just squashed it down to the emission region. I take the emission region just to be the width of the pulse. And I have to choose a frequency. This is all at 1 gigahertz. Because basically almost all these observations, not the ones down here, but all these observations are done at 1 gigahertz. So it doesn't really fit on this plot very well because it's a frequency dependent thing.
So you're saying if the nanoshot had that electric field, then it must be there? Is that what you're saying?
Well, I'm saying if the nanoshot was up here, then the inferred electric field would be equal to the Schwinger. Schwinger field.
But it's not.
And inferred electric field is saying in a centimeter cube, all the energy of the.
Yeah, I'm just taking all the energy and sticking it in the side of a basketball. But actually, if you, as I'll describe later, this curve shouldn't be here, it should be there. And also, this Crab NS point is actually too low. Most of the nanoshots are up here. Well, because I just take these numbers, and it doesn't fit with the brighter nanoshots. I mean, there's a distribution of things, and this was sort of a conservative estimate. So anyways, you know, some nanoshots have this valve. So this suggests that maybe things might be more important. QED might be more important. Okay, so the QED effect I'm going to concentrate on is Schwinger pair production. So keep in mind that in order to produce these things, you need a lot of charge. And if you produce the charge in situ, you have to make about 0.2 moles per meter cubed per nanosecond. So in the presence of a strong electric field, pairs will be spontaneously produced from the vacuum. Now, I guess this effect has been seen sort of indirectly in heavy ion collisions, but it's never been observed very directly. And one of the goals of people that are producing more and more powerful lasers is to actually do this in the laboratory. So that might be something in the next two decades we'll see. So you have to be careful about what you mean by electric field. So we define the electric field or magnetic field in the collinear frame. Basically, you can always go to a frame where the electric field is parallel to the magnetic field. And that's where you define the electric and magnetic field. You know, there's two relativistic invariants, E dot B and B squared minus E squared. But anyways, you can write down the rate of pair production by this formula here. So it's a sum over states you're producing pairs in. So basically, I'm thinking about doing this in a very strong magnetic field. So the electrons are stuck to be in certain Landau levels. There's the ground state Landau level. There's the higher Landau levels. So basically, the ground state means it's not, you know, if you like, in the classical view, it's not rotating around the magnetic field. It's sort of sitting still. The next higher state, it's rotating a little bit, and it's rotating bigger and bigger. So it's a sum over all these states. Now, the thing to notice here is that there's this exponential suppression. And the electric field goes in the denominator in the exponent. So if the, and there's, of course, a negative sign in front. So if the electric field is very small, then this number is very big. So it's e to the minus a very big number. So it's very, very small. And the types of fields I'm thinking about is like 10 to the 12 Gauss, 10 to the 13 Gauss, a little bit below the Schwinger field. And in that limit, you can ignore all the higher states. Everything, all the pairs essentially will be created in the lowest Landau level with spin aligned with the magnetic field to minimize the energy. So you can, in that case, you can take things to be given by this equation. Now, suppose we said we're near the Schwinger field. So you.
Question. So I mean, I can have zero magnetic field and still have Schwinger pair production. So what are you like on this formula?
You can, yes, yeah. If you sum up all the, if you take this sum over all the Schwinger levels, say with a finite b, you'll get a function like tanh e over b here if you do the sum. And then in the limit of small e over b, this b will cancel the one in the denominator. So you'll get the same answer as if b was zero in that limit. It's not sort of obvious.
Here you assume b is much bigger than e.
Here I'm assuming b is much bigger than e. No, actually, I'm not assuming that. This approximation is assuming
the last
approximation. Yeah, it goes to the right answer in the case of b equals zero as well. Okay, so the thing to note is that if you're near the Schwinger field, then this exponent would be about one. And you could say, well, just stick in the Schwinger value here, how much charge do you produce? Well, then you produce 10 to the 24 moles per meter cubed per nanosecond. So that's way too much. We don't need that much. So in other words, it's never going to get anywhere near the Schwinger field. And that's why the Schwinger field isn't really the relevant quantity. Because if you got anywhere near there, you'd already produce enough field to short out whatever electric field you had. And then there'd be no Schwinger, no electric field to produce any more pairs. So you basically saturate long before you get to the Schwinger field. And so.
Sorry, I think I'm really confused now.
What?
Because if what I just said was correct, then you cannot have Schwinger pair production. If B is bigger than E, there is no Schwinger pair production. Because you can always go to a frame where.
No, you can't go to a frame where B is zero.
No, if they're parallel, you cannot do that.
If E dot B is not equal zero, you cannot go to a frame. Yeah. So anyways, this is too much, so we'll never get near the Schwinger field. So basically, what determines the limiting field? Well, basically what determines the limiting field in the case I'm talking about, where the electric fields are strong enough and the size of the region is big enough, so the particles get accelerated to the relativistic speeds almost immediately, much bigger than the size of the region. In my case, much bigger than, scales much smaller than the size of the region, or scales much smaller than the size of a basketball. So in the fields I'm talking about, remember it goes to 10 PeV across the basketball, so the time to get it to 1 MeV is just, the length to get to 1 MeV is really, really small, it's microscopic. So basically all the particles move at the speed of light immediately. So in that approximation, you can calculate what the limiting field is, and it's basically, it's the rate at which the pair production basically would balance out the electric field in a light crossing time. It's given by this number here. So it has a Schwinger field here times pi, and there's this logarithm thing. And it turns out that if you calculate the Schwinger pair production rate, it looks like this. So at a little bit below 10 to the 12, I think 1.5 times 10 to the 12 Gauss, the rate is 10 to the minus 35, totally negligible, will never do anything to anybody. If you go above this number, it quickly goes up to 10 to the 20. And so the region that's relevant to short out any sort of field, no matter what the values of these quantities are, is always going to be around here. So basically, the limiting field is always going to be 2.5 or something times 10, between 2.5 and 3 times 10 to the 12 Gauss. So that really is the limiting field in almost any situation you might ever imagine. And it's very insensitive to the parameters we're talking about. So basically, the Schwinger field is just way too big. The limiting field's a bit more than an order of magnitude below it, and it's given that, and that suppression is given by this logarithm. The logarithm's about 20, but some of that gets eaten up by the pi. The log is about 50, some of it gets eaten up by the pi. So Ruffini and his group over the years have written a number of papers of what he called plasma oscillations. And basically, because this is a device which has a very steep IV curve, it's very nonlinear and it does all sorts of funny things. For a clock here. So basically, he did a one zone model, basically uniform electric field. So if you have an electric field, it'll start to get short. In this case, I guess the electric field's decreasing. Eventually, when you reach a certain value, it'll short out, but it'll overshort out because it has this very steep IV curve, and it'll produce too much charge. The electric field will start to decrease, and it'll go past zero, and then this field will change direction. You'll get this oscillation. So if you talk about Schwinger pair production to a lot of people, they'll talk about this plasma oscillation effect, where basically no radiation gets out, and you just produce a whole bunch of charges. Here's a picture of the number of charges increasing and increasing. And so you never see it. It's just sort of hidden in this plasma soup that it makes for itself. But this is a one-zone model. It's a uniform electric field. If you have a finite-sized region, that doesn't necessarily happen. And so we did these simulations. So basically, here's a plot of suppose we have an oscillating electric field that would increase. It gets to the limiting field, 2 times 10 to the 5 Gauss. It shorts itself out. You get these episodes of pair production. There's a different sort of oscillation, but the field never reverses itself, but it stays pretty close to the limiting field. So here's a sort of this is like a 1 plus, a little bit more than 1D simulation. So basically, it's 1D plus, I assume, some radial profile. So here's sort of a space-time plot. Time goes up, space goes across. Here's these little episodes of pair production corresponding to these oscillations. And what I plotted here is the electrons in reds and the positrons in green, and they go off in different directions.
So how do you generate this electric field?
Well, for the purpose of this simulation, it's externally applied. But I don't think that really matters. Because I'm not doing a 2D simulation, I can't self-consistently have the electric field change with time. Though we've started to do 2D simulations, but the sort of numerology you get shouldn't change. It's very insensitive. to what you do, though the details of these little oscillations will actually depend quite a bit on the geometry. So we've done a number of simulations. Some of them look quite different. Some of them you don't get these little wiggles. Some of them you do. Sometimes you'll get the beginning of the chart of the plasma oscillation, the field reversal thing going on. So you can get a lot of different things happen. So anyways, let me move on quickly. So you can calculate, you know, just from Maxwell's equations, you can calculate if this spark were to be happening in a vacuum, so the radiation could propagate freely away from the spark, you can calculate the flux density, wanted all sorts of stuff about the EMP that gets emitted. So anyways, I guess the main points is that the pairs are created rapidly, are created and they rapidly accelerate to the speed of light. In that case, the electromagnetic pulse you get is basically charge separation radiation. That's sort of illustrated here. Here's that same plot again. So basically, if a bunch of particles move in a constant velocity at a constant speed, remember they're all moving very close to the speed of light, then they emit no radiation. So here and here you're emitting no radiation. It's only when the cloud of electrons and positrons are sort of moving with respect to each other in the same volume that you get radiation. And you can show that the flux you get depends only on this is the pair production rate as a function of time, on the pair production rate on your past light cone. That's all you have to calculate. So you just have to calculate the pair production on your past light cone. Here's a plot of that. It goes like, in the pointing vector goes like the square of that. Here's a plot of that in this particular simulation. You see you get these nanosecond spikes. The power you'd get out is the square of these spikes. So basically, what you've got is you've got this long wavelength wave that corresponds to tens of microsecond radiation, so 100 megahertz or less, and the Schrödinger pair production causes this to be converted into gigahertz radiation. So basically, it's the electromagnetic energy is already there, so it could be propagating towards us. But what the Schrödinger pair production mechanism does, it converts it to higher frequency.
Field that is basically constant over the
interaction region. In our case, we allow it to be, it's basically Gaussian, assumed to be Gaussian. It's Gaussian in time. It's Gaussian in space, in all three dimensions.
In all three dimensions.
Yes.
It doesn't satisfy Maxwell's equation.
What?
It satisfy
well, that's why you need the external field. In this one plus simulation, you need to externally apply a field.
And if it was constant, the sources could be at infinity. But I guess
if you do the constant thing, that's what Ruffini did, and you got these plasma oscillations because the size of the region was infinitely long. I wanted to have something that has a finite size so the particles in the electromagnetic pulse can get out.
But the size can be put in by hand. So this 30 centimeters is put in by hand, and this conversion converts 30 centimeters to a nanosecond.
No, it converts something that's much bigger, maybe a few meters, into these nanosecond pulses.
So your spatial size of your thing is also the same, this many nanoseconds. So your thing is actually many meters in size.
Yes, but the sparks
occur in one place, and then you propagate out from that one point.
Okay.
You've got a constant field as far as the spark region goes. Right. Much larger than your spark region.
Yeah, the field region is much larger than your spark region. The spark is the basketball size.
What's the difference?
The factor of 10 or something. Yeah. So basically, it upconverts the radiation, but only by a factor of 10.
So your results?
What?
Your results in
the Well, there's a scaling relation that you get. If you see net, so this is for the spark size, not the region size.
Yeah.
The energy goes like the spark length to the Q power. And in this model of Schrödinger sparks, this number is more or less independent of anything. So basically, you expect this scaling relation. So if you made things, if it was a micro shot, not a nano shot, the energy would be 10 billion times bigger.
Presumably, this mechanism is just going on all the time. So why is it that you would have, so you're explaining this way the energy on the
Well, let me get to that. Okay. So how can you know, so I have a mechanism that can produce gigahertz or higher radiation, but if it's near the surface of the star, it's not going to get out naively. But the thing is that the electromagnetic energy density is much higher than that in the magnetosphere. And so I envision that you had a single particle that encountered this EMP, these particles would rapidly be accelerated by the electromagnetic pulse to ultra-relativistic speeds. And so a train of nanoshots should be able to blast its way through the magnetosphere. So you know, you can see sort of similar things going on in the sun. Here's again that solar ring. But you see that like the, you know, there's things going on the surface, and they cause part, you know, the bits of plasma to move up, to get, you know, basically get pushed up the magnetic field to get out of the way of the thing so it can get out, and it falls back down. And it happens all the time in the sun. And I imagine that's just what's going on. And so that's the answer to your question. Is if this is to work, you have to basically have a small hole, a small soft spot in the magnetosphere where the energy goes out.
What altitude are you envisioning this happening?
What
altitude are you envisioning?
I think it's near the surface.
Why do you want it in the surface?
B field stronger.
The B field stronger. So I'll be the first to admit I don't have a complete.
So we have a whole bunch of pulsars in the galaxy, and we also have Minecraft players. Have you seen other cases?
There's one other pulsar. Is it Gamma? No. That has nano shots. So this seems to be a young pulsar phenomena. I mean, the Crab pulsar is 1,000 years old. Well, magnetars don't seem to exhibit this, I think. I mean, but again, so they have stronger magnetic fields. But you can imagine what's happening is that there's a when a star is young, it has a lot of, it's not a dipole magnetic field. It has lots of small scale structure. And all that small scale structure is going to go away quickly by some mechanism, some sort of diffusive mechanism that allows for magnetic field reconnections. And so basically, an older pulsar, you know, like, shouldn't exhibit this because all the small scale structure would have gone away.
But you never required here a dipole fine field topology. You just required a trigger pair production to be on.
Well, no, a dipole magnetic field would never do this. I think there's small scale structure in young pulsars that are doing this.
So the magnetars are.
Well, they're not this young.
They're not this young. Okay, you're saying Crab is the youngest.
Crab is the youngest pulsar we know about. So,
that's right.
So maybe all this goes away on this time scale of 2,000 years. What?
Maybe you can make.
So anyway, it's a lot of wishful thinking here. So it's all sorts of phenomena with Crab that you have to explain. There's optical, there's gamma ray pulses. And they're correlated with the giant pulses, which are correlated with the nanoshots. So there's a lot of phenomenology that has to be worked out. Why nanosecond? Well, I won't go into that. I have an idea. I don't really know. So anyways, fast radio bursts. So I'm moving on to a second subject. My time's almost up. So fast radio bursts, you might have heard of. They're short, again, short, bright radio bursts. They've never been resolved on the nanosecond time scale. They're not bright enough or luminous enough at Earth to do that. But they have time scales of milliseconds, not nanoseconds. They got into science news, so I guess they're important. The only order 10 have been observed so far. They seem to be not correlated with our galaxy. And there's another thing is people think they're cosmological because they have large dispersion measure, much larger dispersion measure than you expect along their line of sights from the plasma in the galaxy. So basically, here's a plot of radio transients versus in the y-axis is the dispersion measure divided by the expected dispersion measure from a model of our galaxy. So basically, all the points are below one. So there seems like all these things are in the galaxy down here. These are all pulsars in our galaxy. The things that are above one are pulsars in like the Large Magellanic Cloud and these giant radio and these fast radio bursts here. And so the idea that people have had since they were first discovered is that this additional dispersion measure is from the intergalactic medium. And you can show that the dispersion measure in the intergalactic medium, if you go to very, very high redshift, it goes up to 2,000. Can't go bigger than that. The dispersion measure typical from a typical line of sight in our galaxy is about 100. And these things have dispersion measures of 300, up to 1,000. So basically, that would correspond to redshifts of 0.3, 0.9, something like that. So these things are believed to be cosmological, and that's how you can get some idea of what the energy involved is.
Unless it's all in the source, right?
Well, there's an argument that it can't be in the source, which you are free not to believe. So basically, these things show this characteristic fast rise time and exponential fall off. That's believed to be due to scattering, basically micro lensing, not from gravity, but from the plasma in between. So basically, you see this all the time in galactic events where the interstellar medium is believed to be turbulent and be somewhat homogeneous and will cause this scintillation effect. And basically, you expect this exponential fall off from that. And that really only works is if the dispersion measure, if it's what they say it is, you have something like the turbulent medium roughly halfway in between. It's a lensing effect, so it doesn't really work if it's all in the source or it's all near us. It only works if it's roughly halfway in between. So that's an argument you're free not to believe, but it seems like when radio astronomers see this, they go, aha, this is just the scattering effect that we're all used to. So anyways, what are they? Well, you could sort of match the rates to things we know about. They're much more frequent than gamma ray bursts, much less frequent than core collapse supernova. They could be equal, and this is my favorite candidate, to compact binary coalescence, basically two neutron stars spiraling into each other. The rate of that is fairly uncertain, but it's within possibility that it could match the rate of fast radio bursts. The rate of fast radio bursts is roughly 10,000 a day over the whole sky, or a million a year.
About this tail, I thought I had, so I haven't looked into it. I briefly glanced at a paper by Goldreich and a student saying that the properties of the turbulence needed to produce that scintillation tail don't match the, or sort of couldn't be sort of interstellar.
Well, the thing is that I'm not familiar with this paper. I mean, one thing is that the scales at which this turbulence is happening that does this is like parsec scales, like in the middle between galaxies. We have no knowledge of what the intergalactic medium is doing on those scales. If I talk to my colleague Nick Gannett, he'll tell you that you really don't expect much turbulence or anything like that. So this is sort of surprising.
Knowing that pulsars, which are observed to have these in the galactic plane, it's known to be not explainable by any known physics. So the proper explanation of why they happen are these strange quark nuggets, cosmic strings, and dark matter. So those are the reasons in our galaxy that people say things. They're observed even in pulsars. It's not a measurement problem. So I think thinking of the Lorentz and Goldreich paper, it's clearly. I'm not going to predict any of this. Particularly strong series, since we don't understand anything. So I wouldn't take it one way or the other.
Are the two scattering tails? I mean, do they? I don't know if you want to invoke the same. Can you invoke the same unknown effect to explain both? What do you
mean, muffled strings?
I just mean that the two tails have the, or the, is the relevant length scale and time scale the same?
Coincidentally, again, I think that it's so little known that I think it would be hard to say one way or the other to extrapolate from galactic phenomena to intergalactic phenomena. Again, I wouldn't take this as a qualitative argument one way or the other. Obviously, I had a paper last week arguing that it's in one of the other categories, but
the categories that you argue?
That it's in, well, near other galaxies, galactic centers.
Right.
Yeah, since you mentioned the rays,
anyways, it could be that this shape is intrinsic to the source.
That would be quite a coincidence, of course, because it would have to scale as new to the force.
Yes. But anyways, it could be.
the rays of TBC is also way too low compared to what these fast radio bursts would indicate. So there are also intention there.
Well, I would argue people really don't know that rate, though some phenomena they've measured which suggests it's about almost two orders of magnitude below the fast radio burst rate.
The CDC?
Yeah.
No, even the most optimistic CDCs are two or three orders of magnitude below the fast radio burst rate.
Well, it depends. I mean, if you read the LIGO, advanced LIGO paper, this is the number they quote. People's favorite number is at the low end of this range.
Yeah, but then -4 + 1 - 2 is -5, and you put out there are the rate of the fast rate is much, much larger than
10⁻³.
10⁻³. Now compared with the line of gamma ray bursts. Is it the radio? The rate of fast ray bursts is much larger than
10⁻⁶.
Yeah.
Well, that's gamma ray, right? The fast
ray. Gamma rays on the compact line is the CBCs are more in the same ballpark.
No.
Well, that's because the opposite field of magnitude is the alpha field of magnitude. That's what you're saying, right? If you like -4 - -2, you get -6, which is the GRV rate. If you like the +1, then you would like to equate it.
Well, I mean, misreading what you wrote there, -4 + 1. How do you understand that equation? Between -3 and -6.
Yes.
Between -3 and -6.
Yes. I mean, people think that short radio bursts might be CBCs. They don't think that long radio bursts are. I mean, sorry, short gamma ray bursts are compact binary coalescence, but they don't think that the long gamma ray bursts are the more common ones. So anyways, I think this is reasonable. Some people that model these things think it's reasonable. I don't know. I'm not an expert. Since we've seen very few of these things, we've seen maybe one or two things that are probably compact binary coalescence. It's hard to say. So the Schwinger model of fast radio bursts. Well, the fast radio bursts up here, they're nowhere near this line here. The thing is, if you have a lot of sparks going off at once, you can get anything to the right of the line. So I'm stealing this word invented by someone else called a blitzar. So a billion Schwinger sparks within a few milliseconds. Why not, right? Well, actually, it's more than why not, but basically, people that model coalescing neutron stars, you have, so the time scale here is the simulation begins 7 milliseconds, 13 milliseconds, all the way to 26 milliseconds. Basically, you have, a few tens of milliseconds before all the stuff happens. The two neutron stars are just moving along as if they, they're rotating around each other, but the magnetic field is unchanged. But very quickly, you start seeing MHD turbulence magnifying the fields. You get fields up to 10 to the 15 Gauss. It's hard for me to imagine you could do that without producing Schwinger sparks. It's a very dynamic thing.
But why do you need Schwinger sparks? I mean, just if you have a stuff there, they can short out the electric field itself.
Well, the thing, what the Schwinger sparks do is they do the up conversion. So why do you have these 30 centimeter, these, well, again, we don't know that these things have nanosecond structure, but why do we have these short timescale things? But anyways,
well, I mean, don't you, in reconnection events, that happens, right? We don't have finger production there.
No, you'll get things, but the thing is that the brightness you get in the nano shots you can never do with regular pair production or just accelerating the particles already there, because there aren't enough particles already there, and regular pair production is nowhere near as efficient as Schwinger pair production.
Right, in the neutron star, in the nano shot, like, but here we have like a mess there, so there's lots of particles there, aren't there?
No, the particle density, the initial state is the same as for the Crab pulsar.
Right.
It's very small.
But like I said, I was talking about after merger, you have.
No, after the stars, after the stars start touching, if you like, or something, or then you'll could produce a lot of particles.
But the most problematic part of binding two stars is that, I mean, we just see the fast radio bursts, and there's plenty of energy to go around, even before they merge.
Right.
The nanosphere interactions is releasing tons of energy. These have been calculated. But
yes.
But you have a luminosity 10 to the 43, 10 to the 44 Earth. So
yeah, yeah.
So we're getting away without seeing anything else with binding two stars.
Well, the thing is, if you take a fast radio burst and take that same amount of energy and put it in gamma rays, you get maybe one gamma ray or less. I mean, it's because if you like, the radio is much easier to see for the same energy, the same total energy. The radio is just much easier to see because there are a lot more photons.
In that direction where we're seeing this radio, we should be seeing more of
it. Oh, there'll be lots of energy. If you were co-observing at different frequencies, you probably would see something. Because there's 10 orders of magnitude more energy being released than in the radio.
But would we have seen it if we didn't know?
But if you look a few days later, I mean, people that calculate light curves from these things say they fall off very rapidly. So if you look, you know, a few days later, there's nothing there. So people have recently done real-time observation of a fast radio burst. They only got to look at it like a fraction of a day later, and they saw nothing. But anyways, you know, the point of this simulation is to suggest that you get a jet and produce gamma ray bursts. My thing is that I think in this turbulent thing, you could probably produce a lot of radio emission, which might be, I think Schwinger mechanism will be part of the mix, if you like, of the dynamics of the thing. But maybe as Nayesh says, it's maybe not that important because a lot of radio emission will happen. I mean, the people that do these simulations claim that this is opaque to radio waves and you shouldn't see anything because there's enough plasma, you know, the plasma frequencies, hundreds of gigahertz. But I would claim that you can punch holes in it. Okay, they're frequent. I said this. They might be a good tool. So let's just, you know, forget about Schwinger mechanism. Just assume that these fast radio bursts are major life events for neutron stars. Birth, core collapse, marriage, compact binary coalescence, death, collapse to a black hole, something like that. All these events coincide with copious neutrino and gravitational wave productions. Forget that. And the telescopes that observe gravity waves, neutrinos, are basically all the sky, all the time telescopes. They don't point in a given direction. They point almost everywhere, a fair fraction of the sky. And they record all their data, if you like. Or they could record all their data. And certainly, neutrino telescopes can record all their data. So anyways, you might be motivated to try to capture all the fast radio bursts that you see, all 10,000 a day, by an array of radio telescopes. And you can use these things as triggers to measure gravity waves or neutrinos. Basically, you could even estimate from the dispersion measure a rough idea of the redshift. And actually, if you had widely dispersed radio telescopes on opposite sides of the globe, you could do intensity interferometry and at some level and sort of, you could do time of arrival interferometry, you know, for one thing to begin with, or you could maybe do a bit better than that and sort of get better positions on the sky. Okay, I'm running out of time. So anyways, here's a fast radio burst. Here's a picture of a gravitational wave in spiral event. It happens for long periods of time before the coalescence, and then it sort of turns off. Here's a plot of a model of neutrino emission. It lasts tens of milliseconds. So the curious thing here is the time scale and all these things are milliseconds. Maybe they have something to do with each other. Well, obviously these two have something to do with each other. But the time scale is roughly the right time scale for the fast radio bursts, which is another clue that they might have to do with neutron star binary coalescence. So anyways, let's just get to the plot. So you can imagine one day having a very large neutrino telescope and doping it with gadolinium or something, which is basically an anti-coincidence thing that basically allow you to identify unburst beta decays, the things you expect to get from neutrinos impinging upon your water Cherenkov detector. So in that case, if you have neutrinos coming from fast radio bursts, compact binary coalescence, and you have neutrinos coming from core collapse supernova, the dominant background is for the compact binary coalescence is the core collapse supernova. So you can imagine one day where that's your background. So here's a plot of the background, the core collapse supernova neutrino rate. Basically, I'm this number of inverse beta decays per gigaton per decade. Anyways, per delta log z. Gigaton sort of depressing. So anyways, so that's this. All right, and here's from compact binary coalescence, assuming that FRBs gives you the rate of these things. So it's about a little bit below. The thing is, if you use fast radio burst triggers, you could only look at things that happened around the time of the fast radio burst, in which case you could suppress your background by this amount. So basically, if you just look around the fast radio burst, and if you look at redshifts less than about 0.2, then all the neutrinos around that time are coming from that one particular fast radio burst. So you've basically suppressed your background by many orders of magnitude.
If it is compact binary coalescence, and you get you're detecting all of these, you're detecting every burst in the radio. I mean, can you get the spot on the sky accurately enough to get the redshift of the host galaxy?
You could imagine doing that. It would require a large radio network, but yeah, you could imagine doing that. But the time scale to build a gigaton detector, or to get money together to build a gigaton detector, might be a long time, might be many decades. and during that time, you could imagine getting money together to build your radio network, which probably
just
be.
Just for neutrinos, sorry, I was thinking about just for the, you know, for gravity waves, people always talk about this problem that if you could get the Minkowski distance from the gravity waves and the redshift of the host galaxy.
Yeah, yeah, well, yeah.
But you never can find the host galaxy because the gravitational detector is
if you can get the position of the fast radio burst to, you know, a few arc seconds, then, and if you have a pre-done redshift survey that has the redshift of every galaxy in the universe, which we're approaching that, at least for low redshifts, we can imagine doing that. Then you say, well, yeah, there's one bright galaxy in that direction. It almost certainly came from there.
Why do you don't need to have a pre-done, do you? Why do you just go, you just get the...
No, because I think that's more to do it after the fact. Do you have a rapid response redshifts? I mean, I think you should build the infrastructure. You do redshift surveys, and you have a map of all the galaxies and all the redshifts. I think that's the way you should do things. You're right, you could do it after the fact. So anyways, who's going to build such a big detector? Well, there's some interest in the national security infrastructure of the world to monitor reactors and nuclear bombs going off. And there's actually a sort of pilot program that's actually being built called Watchmen. I don't know if this is someone put this on one of their slides. I don't think that's their actual logo, but. Well, anyway, so they can see you, basically. We can see you if you're building a reactor. But the most outrageous proposal in this direction was by John Learned, who suggested 1,000 10 gigaton water detectors, basically bags of water at the bottom of the bags of purified water at the bottom of the ocean. That could detect very small reactors almost anywhere in the world, except for central Russia, which happens to be very far from any ocean. Anyways, maybe someday people will cobble together enough money to do this. You can also measure very small nuclear explosions. But again, it might cost a lot of money. The main cost is the photodetectors, not the water. Water's cheap. Another thing you could do with fast radio bursts and gamma and neutrinos is, because neutrinos have a mass, the time of arrival will depend on the energy. You measure the energy, the time of arrival, and if you knew when the thing went off, say by a fast radio burst, here's your fast radio burst trigger, then you see that the neutrinos, depending on energy, arrive several tens of milliseconds later. And of course, one thing I didn't mention is that normally with a neutrino telescope, you don't really see anything unless you get several neutrinos from the same event. If you have a fast radio burst, you can start probing that large population of things that you only get one neutrino. Because basically, you're correlating the fast radio burst with the neutrino, not the neutrino with another neutrino. So basically, you have a fast radio burst or a bunch of fast radio bursts. You sort of fill in the energy time of arrival plot. You get something like this. In this particular case, because we know that all neutrinos don't have the same mass. There's a mass splitting. You get these two branches. So it's all sorts of interesting physics you can do. So you get the time of arrival versus redshift. And there's a formula that gives you the time delay as a function of distance. So you can develop another distance indicator, basically based on time of arrival. For a giga detector with a decade, you could get below the percent level for Hubble constant. We're getting close to that now, so maybe this will be a moot point by the time anyone builds gigaton detectors. But you could do this in principle. It'd be a pretty very simple physics way of measuring the Hubble constant. Or you could also increase the reach of gravitational wave detectors. So basically, if you could measure all of these, if you measured a million fast radio bursts, you could increase your sensitivity of your gravitational wave detector, at least in a statistical sense, sort of stacking all the fast radio burst signals. So basically, what the effect of this is, you could take a detector which is only sensitive to things up to 100 megaparsecs and start measuring events that happen at redshift of 0.7. So basically increasing your reach by several orders of magnitude. So that's sort of a real thing that's going to be capable of doing very soon, because Advanced LIGO starts next year. If you had this radio detector array happening, you start building it now, in a few years, maybe you could have it actually running. And another thing you should mention is the quantity of gravity. It's, if you like the number of gravity waves you tag with this method, not the number of fast radio bursts. So you don't actually have to look at the very far away fast radio bursts. You have to look at the close ones. So you could use smaller radio telescopes. It already is next year. I forgot. So if the fast radio bursts I should use my microphone. I don't know why this thing is not appearing.
Is that the fast radio burst?
This is, if the fast radio bursts are producing gravity waves, like, this is the rate you get. And you get close to this with something not much bigger than Advanced LIGO, at least in terms of detecting individual chirp signals. So anyways, to summarize.
But yeah, I mean, also, if you just have a redshift, if you can associate each of those guys, each of those blips with a redshift also, and you're like, you measure the expansion history.
Yes, yes.
Very well, and the Hubble constant very well.
Right. I mean, yes, people, the chirp distance that people have defined, yeah. So anyways, there's this ultra-bright phenomena thing that's going on that not many people are aware of, and I think it's sort of, people are not exactly sure how it works. It has something to do with coherent emission. They know that much. And so I'm suggesting that a heretofore unobserved QED phenomena, Schwinger maxim, may play a very important role in making these very bright radio transients. And so particularly, I'm proposing that Schwinger sparks are sort of the proximate emission mechanism for both Crab nanoshots and fast radio bursts. It's sort of neutron star senility in the sense that you see these things when a neutron star is just born, and then you see it later in life when they coalesce or they form a black hole, perhaps. But irrespective of the emission mechanism, if fast radio bursts are associated with neutron star major life events, they probably could be a very valuable tool for gravitational radiation astronomy, as well as neutrino astronomy. Okay, that's it.
Questions for Albert?
So you talk about 10 million a year. Now, Time is intending to find a kind of the 5 per year, not quite that many, but a good chunk of them. And is that useful at all, or is that way too low?
No, I think that would be useful for advanced LIGO. But I would say that the thing is that, as I mentioned, I think if you were doing this to find triggers or to tag gravitational waves or neutrinos, you wouldn't go with the large telescope option. You go with the small telescope option where you cover a larger area of the sky much less deeply. I was thinking even cheaper than that. You know, few meter dishes, widely dispersed over the globe. You just look for coincidences. But that's if you have several chimes. I mean, there's not too much point in building several chimes from the point of view of 21 centimeter astronomy. You maybe build a few. Certainly one in the north, one in the south.
Without any extra effort, I think you
would help
bring a good chunk of
time
all the time.
Okay, well, I'm all for that.
Would you look for coincidences on this
landscape?
Well, the thing is that suppose you have 10 Li and Chime. If 10 Li sees a fast radio burst, Chime's not going to see it because they're looking in a different direction at the same time.
But it wouldn't be spatial coincidence, but it'd be, at least for stacking between them, you don't.
For neutrino stacking, as long as your individual thing could you know, with confidence measure these things, then you can use it for stacking.
And you could use the gravitational wave telescope for the constants.
What?
Yeah, I mean, if you detect the gravitational wave at that time, that's...
No, but the thing is that the usefulness of this, I think, is to be sensitive to gravitational wave sources, which are way in the noise. They're way in the noise. You'd never be able to see it just with advanced LIGO itself.
Because they went for 9 month run, and with those rays, they could have seen very much.
I don't know if that's, so that's true? I mean, what is the depth of LIGO?
So today, I think it's 50 megaparsec, but the last run, so if you take that rate,
Well, no, but you wouldn't see any of it. 99.9% of them are way below the noise. You never detect it with it.
No, because now you take it to the -3 per galaxy, then you check how far was at enhanced light received.
Right.
And on the right. So they didn't run for a full year. So they only run for 9 months. And they would have had one or two signals.
So how many Milky Way equivalent galaxies are within their range?
In the previous range, I can remember.
Okay. You might be right.
But now within this issue should be put to rest within
yeah.
a year.
Yeah.
3 months would a farther reach this time in 6 months or next year. So So that would be pretty cool.
Okay, sorry to have. All right, go ahead.
Let's take that over again.